Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. My guest for this episode is John Paul Maxfield, a business owner from Denver, Colorado, who launched a sustainable agriculture company that began as a successful commercial composting business. The journey began in 2009 with a truck and $9,000. Now, he and his team are on the next stage of that journey, providing products and tools empowering individuals to reconnect with the food system and in turn make urban farming more accessible to everyone. Part of this occurs through their Maxfield brand of products, which serves as the basis for their ability to do good work. When I first heard about JP and his company, I was reminded of the conversation with Andrew Faust on the difference New York City could make by processing food waste in the city rather than shipping it out by the truckload, how that could in turn build healthy soil and allow more food to be grown in the metropolis. There is so much food and lawn refuse in the United States and elsewhere that composting and other related businesses present numerous possibilities to leverage creativity and permaculture design into sustainable solutions in the current market. We can combine business, for-profit, and permaculture. Where JP and Waste Farmers make a difference is in tying the business to a set of values that guide the work each day, rather than try and reiterate these ideas in my own words. Here's the Maxfield's vision statement. At Maxfield's, we believe that the hope for worldwide agricultural harmony begins in every backyard. The revolution starts small, and it starts with your own two hands. Establish your roots, work with nature, celebrate the harvest, and cultivate the farmer within. If you'd like to learn more about this mission statement and ideas, you can see the 10 core values that guide JP and his team at wastefarmers.com/what, and I've also listed them in the show notes. Best of all from all of this, though, JP and crew are making this work. It's a model of success to consider. Though the world of permaculture design is broad, there's room for everyone to find their way to make a difference in building a better world, and that's why I chose to interview him. I'll join you after the interview with some further thoughts.
The way that I read your bio is that you do have experience as like a traditional farmer raising livestock and things like that, or did I read too far into that?
Well, the larger point of that is my great-grandfather was actually one of the largest sheepmen in the country at one point, just after World War One, and that was over in part of the country like Fort Collins, which is where New Belgium Brewery is, if you're familiar with that, like Fat Tire Brewery. That's what people know about Fort Collins these days. Over in Wyoming and Nebraska, you know, that's things like running sheep feedlots and all the things that are incorporated with industrial agriculture. And then my grandfather had a sale barn and like a vertically integrated agriculture-based business, of which some of my dad's brothers took over. And I always speak to that because I think it's important for us as we look to move forward in the context of solving global food issues and solving even broader issues that are related to life, like we were talking about, on a more philosophical, spiritual level. We've got to understand where we've come from. And I've never read the work of Michael Pollan, not out of any sort of spite or ill will, but I think that it kind of triggers a visceral reaction to people who have worked really hard to get us where we are and give us exactly, us being society, culture, whatever, exactly what we wanted. It's not fair to demonize that side of things. We have to respect, you know, where we've come from in order to move forward. And I always reference them out of respect, to say that, you know, if they were here now, they would say, look, our goal was a pretty well-intentioned experiment. We can make food cheap. We can industrialize the system. We can free people from work on the farm. We can progress civilization. We can do all these things that have gotten us to this point. And I think if they were here now, they would acknowledge that that experiment, wouldn't call it a failure, but it was a learning experience and it can't continue moving forward. And so that's why I reference them, because my experience of agriculture has always been one sort of an industrial perspective and thinking about it from a business perspective. When it snows here in Denver, you can always catch the smell of manure because it comes from the Northwest and a lot of the feedlots from Denver up Northwest. And so growing up, you know, it was always like, that's the snow's coming and that's the smell of money. And so my own journey has been one from kind of looking at agriculture as this industrial process and then sort of coming to realize that that mentality can't continue moving forward, and agriculture being biological and sort of based in all the things that you guys talk about on your podcast, diversity requires small scale attention. And so I think that in the same respect that agriculture took quite a long time relative to other processes to industrialize, you know, 1960s, so sort of hundred years or so after the Industrial Revolution, it took a long time because it's hard to industrialize a biological process. And in that same respect, I think that it's going to be one of the first to decentralize, which is exciting. And so for our company, we want to solve issues. And the things that most interest me, and I think the place where my talents are best suited, is in agriculture and working to help find solutions that help humanity feed itself and do so in a way that decreases ag's environmental footprint. So sort of a global mission. And along that journey, kind of discovered that the best place to start is kind of with the self. And that's philosophical aspect, spiritual aspect, but also just self being this energy, this form of energy is one of the easiest to decentralize. And what kind of drove the point home, actually, there were two experiences. We had fellows from what's called Bold Leaders, Bold Food Program. So we had, it's an exchange program between leaders in global food security. It's an exchange of information, exchange of culture. So 12 delegates from Kenya, Uganda came to the U.S. One of them stayed with us, a gentleman by the name of Mike Lakwale, PhD in soil science, actually from Kentucky, and worked for the Department of Agriculture and Agronomist in Nairobi. So he was with us for a month. And just on a variety of levels, we learned more from him than he did from us. And then there were some other fellows that went to, I think some went to Growing Power in Milwaukee. Some went to various other urban ag focused groups in Colorado. So sort of like Midwest. And at the end of the program, I think they were here for a month. Everyone gets together and, you know, all 12 tour each of the various facilities and learn where. So Michael gave a tour of our facilities and our process. And at the end, we sat around a conference room table and we got to chatting. And one of the gentlemen from Uganda, who was the Rabbit Man, I think it was his nickname, but he said something pretty profound. He said, because we were talking about global food security and the issues facing things and the assumptions that the U.S. has it all figured out, at least that's our assumption, I think, sometimes. And he said something that stuck with us. And it was, look, I came here thinking I would come to the most food secure place on the planet, and I found the exact opposite. He said, where I'm from, we all have gardens. We all have farms. We depend on each other. For you guys, if a truck doesn't make it over I-70, you guys will starve. And you know, something that's pretty profound just to take a step back and think about it, because if you, and I talked about it a bit in that presentation, if you fast forward a bit, you know, there's groups and there's organizations, there's former presidents that talk a lot about the work that they're doing in other countries, which is awesome to help push and progress their development. But often I think we neglect the fact that mistaking material wealth for food security, for instance, is a mistake. And so the first place that we saw that we could actually make a tangible difference was focusing on the self, and through our Maxfield manifestation of the Waste Farmer mission. Maxfield is our brand of products to kind of help cultivate and empower the farmer in everyone, starting in backyards or on balconies or wherever they have space, from somebody who's just starting to the most advanced nerdy horticulturist like some of us. So that's kind of how the evolution went from thinking of agriculture as like this big industrial complex to narrowing it down to kind of to the self, and then working back that way, back out. So I hope that makes sense.
No, it does. My interview process usually is a little bit different from the road that we've gone down. I started with that question for a bit of clarity on the background, and normally would have begun our conversation after a longer dialogue.
You can just tell me to shut up.
Oh, no, that's okay. You started touching on the points that I had written down in my notes to begin the conversation with your biography and background. So the places that you went, it was just easier to let you go and capture all that, because the time that I spent putting notes together, you just took care of about half of those just by allowing you to start. As soon as I was ready to interrupt with a question, you picked up the next piece and continued with it. So I'm looking at my notes going, okay, let's see where we can go from here.
Totally. And so, well, maybe I can tell you where we started.
What I wanted to get is, how did you transition from your previous life in private equity and as an analyst to doing this farming work, and then use that to move into a discussion of your current company and what you're doing.
Sure. So I got let go from the company I was with, and let go is a nice way of firing. I think they had a brilliant way. In that world, I think the best way to fire someone is to convince them it's their idea. And so I had always had a desire and romance associated with agriculture just from family ties and a lot of respect for my grandpa and my dad and my uncles. And when you talk about like growing up on a farm, it's a very different thing because it's business, right? Business that I didn't see. And my dad was sort of on the periphery of in the later years. So it was 2008 when I got let go, and it was a huge blessing because I had an excuse to kind of do what I really wanted to do. I always felt like there was more, right? And, you know, having a wife and a child on the way, it's not easy unless there's a reason to let go of all the false security that jobs in that world give you. So I traded in my IRA, which wasn't much, and I traded in my wife's car for a pickup truck. I saw the opportunity, or I knew the opportunity. I saw, you know, food waste being thrown away in Denver, and wanted to capture it so that we could start using it to make a raw material for some of our soil products. But in order to do that, it's really, you know, it's a long-winded way of saying, because we have a lot of land in Colorado, unused land rather, relative to you guys out east, it's really cheap for us to throw things away. So for you guys out east, it actually is an economic benefit for you to compost, and because landfill rates are so expensive. But for here in the west, it's not the case because we have so much open space to build holes and bury stuff. So in order to capture compost cost effectively, we had to be creative, and we had to kind of outsource various parts of the recycling trash stream kind of wholesale so that we could pass those costs off and make composting a cost neutral thing. So that's how we initially got started. We viewed compost as part of our broader mission of being this global sustainable agriculture company as a first step where we're consumers by putting things into a green composting bin. It's a physical act of the sustainable things of recycling that those nutrients back in the system, but it's also a reconnection point where consumers start the first process of coming back to the production process. You mend the lines between consumers and producers and start, you know, personalizing those things again. So that was an important part of that effort as well. And so we built that up and threw it, and we sold it. And so to answer your question, the private equity part was about learning the language of business. And I joke sometimes about being a wolf in sheep's clothing in the sense that I will speak the language of business, and it's important to do so. But I also want to see big change and rapid change for a positive change. And I think that in order to achieve that, the things that are wrong with capitalism can also be the things that help mend the system. And so understanding the language of business is key. And we want to build a profitable business because the bigger we grow from that perspective, the more we can bring on like-minded people to join the journey and to do good things. So that private equity experience is really, really, really important. And from an entrepreneurial perspective, if people want to start companies, they need to understand financials, and they need to understand business and be able to speak the language of business, because it's crucial if you want to succeed in that realm. Does that make sense?
No, it does, because the world that we currently exist in is some form of capitalism, whatever form you want to say that it may particularly take, whether it's a government-supported or a regulated or a corporate capitalism. However it is, that's the world that we exist in. And if you want to reach out to people beyond an insular community, you have to be able to speak their language and meet them where they are,
right?
Not expect them to bring their toys to where you are.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. That's exactly right.
That seems to be an ongoing conversation within the permaculture community and many of my other guests, is how do we bridge some of those divides? And certainly being able to put on a suit and go and sit down with someone who is used to interacting with the world in a certain way is a lot easier in some ways if you're ready to do that than it is to ask them to, you know, put on their wellies and come out to your farm and muck around in the dirt and the mud and learn what you're doing, that you can bring your stuff to them.
You know, for everyone within, say, that realm, like, not to put dichotomies to it, like, there are people that even on that realm very much speak the language, and it's just a matter of finding those people. And I think that, as I say, like, capitalism, we started with $9,000. That was my IRA, and a belief that idealism and capitalism can kind of coexist. And I still believe that. And there's inherent contradictions in that. And there's also inherent contradictions in the whole concept of agriculture, because we trace it a step further. Agriculture is really what, and a lot of people, particularly permaculture, like there's the knowledge of agriculture is what furthered our separation as humans from natural systems, right? And then that cheap food propels the consumptive economy, propels where we are now. But agriculture, I believe, on the home level, on the self level, is what also, in the same respect that it disconnected us some 10,000 years ago, I think it's also what can help sort of bring us back, create that bridge, like you talked about, back into the natural world. And so that's why, you know, with our company, we talk about cultivating the farmer within. And I think that's where we're coming from that perspective. Like, it'd be wonderful if we could all go back to, say, that hunter-gathering lifestyle. But in terms of seeking solutions, all 9 billion people on the planet aren't going to all at once. Unless all 9 billion people on the planet by 2050 simultaneously agree to just, you know, call off all civilization as it stands and all systems, we've got to find other solutions. And so while the hunter-gathering lifestyle might be gone, at least for the time being, farming is an option that's open to everybody. And it's not people on big tracts of land and tractors. It's, you know, something as simple as a pot in the backyard, even something very simple. I hope that makes sense.
No, it does. There's a recent video that was released by Toby Hemingway that talks about the movement of society from hunter-gatherers to horticulturists, then finally to agriculture and farming.
Yep.
So there's a part of that that's that transition back to small-scale production, whether you want to call that agriculture or gardening or horticulture. There's a place for that small scale in moving forward. Now, one question that I have, since we've touched on permaculture, have you studied permaculture formally, or did that serve in any way to bring you where you are, or is it just helping to inform your current viewpoint as you move forward?
You know, I'm not a particularly good student. I read a lot, and I think that it's reinforced the journey, if that makes sense. Looking at permaculture now has helped to put into context the journey that's led us here to date before I understood what it was. It was more a retrospective, the things in the past in context that I really made sense. Because sometimes you just act intuitively and you don't realize what's going on until you reflect.
Being in the world of permaculture and that idea that, you know, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. With how broad the permaculture base of knowledge is, it's very easy to look at a variety of things from the permaculture side and call them permaculture. Just as I'm sure with your retrospective, all these things that you've done, you look at this broad umbrella and you go, oh, okay, I see how what I've been doing led to this place, and it all kind of fits together now.
What permaculture has been is reassuring that, and it's not that you seek acceptance or that like that we seek acceptance, but sometimes it's just good to know that you're not crazy and that there's other, I don't know, it validates things. It's nice. Toby's books have been amazing. And I read actually his piece on the hunter-gathering, and I think he did an article on it too. And I was nervous though that, and that's why I preface with, I don't want to demonize agriculture because until the very end of his article, and I don't know if you know the one I'm referring to, but I assume it's the same video that you were talking about. It was on the verge of romanticizing the hunter-gathering lifestyle to the point of making too stark of a contrast between agriculture and hunter-gathering. And I think the point that we're making, and I think he made towards the end of the article, is that those things can coexist together. And indeed, they have to. But there was a point where I was like, oh, no, please don't go this route. But he came back around, so... which I was really happy to see. It was a really good piece. He's a great writer.
I can say that I had some similar concerns as he was going there. I was like, what direction are we going to go with this?
Right.
Because some of the conversations, depending on the perspective, become, well, we just need to kind of let it all fall apart before we can rebuild it. And that kind of scares me in many ways to think about allowing something like that to happen. I'm very much a let's figure out a way to move civilization towards a change, and if there is any kind of a failure, that it's a soft landing and not some kind of a, well, we jumped off the cliff and we're looking through the cloud bank and don't know what's beneath it.
That's exactly right, and that's where I was coming from too. Like, you know, and we always say, sort of as a company, we're a company seeking solutions. Our purpose statement is actually sort of, let me read it to you, because it's very general, right? But it makes sense. Like, our purpose statement is, we are cosmic journeymen seeking solutions inspired by natural systems, human potential, and intuitive imagination, with the intention of enhancing the biosphere, local communities, and one's authentic life. was a very broad purpose statement, but it helped us sort of find meaning. And I think that that focus on solutions is where we want to sit. And he could very well be right, right? We could be marching towards a cliff, and that might be the only way we wake up. I always kind of joke, like, the Democrats in 2004 with John Kerry, or like an alcoholic after they hit rock bottom. Like, maybe it takes us hitting rock bottom, but nonetheless, the things that you talk about with your blog and the things that people within this realm are working towards are the things that are going to help rebuild in the event that it does have to come to that point. And maybe if we work hard enough, we can avoid that, which would be the hope. Avoid that catastrophic rock bottom. Maybe we can buck the odds and get those glimpses of clarity and be able to rebound instead of having to hit rock bottom.
I keep my fingers crossed that we can make it and get there. It's that, well, as you mentioned, the 9 billion in 2050, there are some numbers that I was reading recently that right now, with where global development is going and growth and moving people out of poverty, that right now is the most number of children that have ever or could ever exist on the earth because of leveling population growth. As our population numbers slowly come down, we're almost at the point where we're just at replacement rates. Like, I think it's 2.2% or something. And I'm getting really technical here for a second on the numbers. But a friend and I talk about it, that if we can make it to like 2050 and that 9 billion number that you mentioned, that could be the highest number of people that we ever reach. As we elevate people out of poverty, they have less children, there's less of a need to reproduce in large numbers, that then we slowly reach a point where we stabilize and then global population begins to naturally decline without, if you will, needing an epidemic or running up against that carrying capacity that our technology currently allows us to step past. So yeah, I just keep my fingers crossed that we can make it to mid-century, continue to spread and share this information. And then a lot of these catastrophes that authors like Ehrlich were talking about with like the population bomb in the 1970s, that we don't actually hit those limits, that we can move past them, and all this stuff kind of happens softly. From that digression, you mentioned your mission statement, or your purpose, and then in your mission statement you touched on earlier about being able to provide tools for farmers in the 21st century to meet their needs. One of the other pieces that you sent me was the values of your company, and I don't want to go through all of them. There are a couple that I highlighted. If it's okay with you, I would like to post all this in the show notes on the website for people to be able to quickly reference. Also, then if when they download it to their MP3 player, they can look at the notes and have all this on hand and not have to go to the website.
Sure.
But in your values, one of the things from this conversation and the purpose, mission, and all that is that you really seem to be using the company and the products you're producing in order to leverage your position to help people.
Yep.
And that really comes through in the values. Do you find that those values really guide the direction of the company? Like, do you sit down and reconsider them and make sure that you're meeting those values?
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. I mean, you know, it's funny. I met with a mentor of a really fast-growing company here in Colorado that I respect. And they've grown an incredible amount. They're a really great company. And we spent an hour and a half together. They're actually just ranked one of the top 10 most promising companies in the country. And we spent an hour and a half kind of talking. And the whole time we talked about all of the culture-related things about his company. And so we spent literally an hour and a half working through culture and vision and all of the things that would be seemingly sort of intangible. But there's no coincidence that the success and the growth of his company is out of a really intense focus on their values and their culture and their people and the mission that drives them. And so it drives us every day. There was actually, and I'll be candid, we got our first piece of hate mail, which is interesting. After a long day, we had just gotten new equipment to scale up our production line of our soil products and our organic soil products for the Maxfield line of tools. I walked in and I got this letter that was basically directed at the company. And the irony is the company is only five people. And it said, look, someone sent me a note to your company with the assumption that you were this sustainable company that was doing all these great things. But coconut coir is awful. And coconut coir is going to, you know, be the same thing that palm oil is. And it's going to enslave people. And it's going to, and granted, it's better than peat moss, but still it's awful. And paraphrasing, the world's going to end when fossil fuels reach their peak and you guys are going to be screwed. So nice try, but you guys suck, was basically the gist of it. And so number one, I responded and I copied the whole company, which is five people, including my mom, on accounts payable. Actually, she's the accounting department. And I said, thank you for the note. I think you've got us confused with a company that is out to greenwash. But I can assure you that we've done our, because he was very interested in research. Like, he had researched all this stuff. And I said, I can assure you that we've done our research too. And then we did it again. And then we ate research for lunch and digested it and did it some more. And we were actually just having a conversation about Coco Coir and how we can't wait to replace it, just as we did with peat. But we're not there yet. And I said, you know what else we don't like about our products? The fact that it comes in plastic bags, right? We tried compostable bags and they composted. We tried burlap sacks and they composted. If you have any ideas, Richard, please let us know. You know what else I don't like? Perlite. It's the worst. We worked really hard to replace it, and we did actually successfully replace it with an alternative made from recycled glass. But the Organic Materials Review Institute would not accept it, or really actually the Organic Standards Program wouldn't accept it, because making a glass is not a natural process. It's a man-made process, which we understand, but it's just sand in the end. So no, we're back to the drawing board with that. We use a micronutrient that is sourced locally, but is mined. We would love to replace that, but we're not there yet. We think we can get there through biodynamic composting, but there's certain elements of the micronutrients that we really need to make a product that people want and people can use right now. And then further, we hope eventually that our soil products do so well that feeding the microbes and the life in the soil, that people don't have to buy them anymore. They can continue to build a solid ecological foundation and then grow their garden that way. So it's all to say that it was the first time where we've grown and realized that we see it every day. And you can relate, being a father. Like, my son's 3 weeks old now, and this is a busy time of the year for us. So we're working hard. And so I told my wife that he's grown a lot, and she doesn't see it because she's with him, 24/7. And I think the same for the company. We're growing, and we don't realize that we're getting a little bit bigger. And I think that, this guy was reaching out to a faceless group of people that he didn't know to give them a lesson on sustainability. And what he didn't realize is that we were already three steps ahead, but we're working every day to make it better, and we always will. But that's why that value statement, the only progressive move is to move forward. We've taken a stand, and whenever you take a stand, right, whenever you put your feet down and you start working on something, there's inherent contradictions in all of it. It's the very back to the core of hunter-gathering versus farming and agriculture, to that level, like capitalism, idealism, all these things are contradictions in all of it. But there's things that we can do every day to mindfully sort of move forward, and that's what we're doing. And I told him, look, I'm glad you reached out. Come out and help us. If you've got alternatives, we are open to all of them and always will be. And, though our intentions are true right now, keep us honest as we grow. Hold us to it. And most importantly, though, help us find solutions, because too many out there, particularly in the sustainability movement, that are focused on problems, and that doesn't solve anything. It's easy. And what I also told him is, he said he was a master composter, which is awesome. And I said, what you don't know about us is that everyone copied on this email, the company, was in a truck navigating the streets of Denver, washing out maggot-filled bins to make commercial composting, a reality in Denver. And it wasn't before. The economics were entirely against it. And those efforts diverted 9,000 tons from the landfill. It was an impassioned email, but we take what we're doing really seriously. And we don't claim in the least to know it all. We don't claim to be doing everything right. But we do claim to be working towards solutions and being honest and, working every day to find solutions and keep it, the ball kind of pushing forward and inching forward.
To speak to the hate mail, I've received some of my own, being of now, as strange as it seems, with only a few thousand listeners, I am now a public figure in my own way and downloaded by people all over the world. And I found that generally, it was very strange when I contacted you, you were like, I love your show. And I'm like, oh, great, somebody listens to it. That's awesome. But I'm going to interview someone who listens to the show. But yeah, receiving hate mail, it's very often the anger isn't really directed at me. It's just that needing someone to vent their own frustrations to. And I really appreciate, honestly, receiving that kind of hate mail, because it allows me then to respond to their needs. Like for me, I received one message that I got really steamed about, and it took me 4 or 5 hours to get over what had been sent to me and realize that whole, no, they're not angry at me. This is the core part of their message that they're upset about. And then sit down and write a response that allowed me to meet them where they were and find a way to ask, well, how can I help you and you in turn aid me? Just as you mentioned, you know, this is what we know. We don't like these things. We tried these methods and it didn't work. But I also like, and the listeners will get to read through the values, what you walked through really pointed very well to that fourth value of your company. You, if you will, embodied it for a few moments in that discussion of don't be right to seek truth. If you have another way, show us, let us know that, you know, we don't know it all. And I think that's really great. But some of those values that I wanted to ask you about is your third value is believe there is more than less. But trust that less is more. I apologize. The way my brain works, I'm running through that sentence and diagramming it in order to parse it. But it sounds to me like that's a reflection of abundance, that it's our viewpoint leads to the place that we're at. And changing that view can show us that there is more available, even if we're not collecting as much stuff.
Absolutely. And it's further, too, in terms of dual. I mean, all these are sort of on dual planes. And you've heard the terms like brevity is the soul of wit. And so as we develop products too, you know, we want simplicity in the things that we develop, the things that we design, the messages that we send out. Simplicity is the message there and across all levels. And I think it's interesting that you picked up on that, which is cool. So it's interesting to hear you interpret them because it's right. And it's, I didn't think anyone would pick up on that. It's actually very cool.
It's the conversation about scarcity and how that leads to fear-based thinking. And I'm dealing with issues of cultural and natural resource law right now. And it's how much scarcity drives that conversation and the use of resources. And, well, if you change that viewpoint and point to the abundance in the area where you are, can that take away some of that fear and some of that fight or flight kind of reaction? Rather than fall down that rabbit hole as I could, and I'd probably break my leg on the way down, one of your core values, as I say, about being a permaculturist and looking at everything through that lens, is your fifth, strength through diversity, life builds life. Through that, you mean by like building the soil and building the material, getting people to interact and accept diversity, that we find strength both in ourselves and resiliency in the environment?
But further, it gets into the whole decentralization of agriculture, and agriculture is a biological system that requires, and being biological, its strength is in its diversity. And if we talk about agriculture and sort of permaculture in that same respect, small scale attention, that means the diversity of farmers, the diversity of tenders, of people engaged in that exercise, that practice of diversity is even of farmers is important because, you know, it gets to be like, as the number of farms or the size of farms have increased, the number of farmers has decreased. It's what you touched on, and it's really related to the agricultural system as well. And life builds life is starting from that solid foundation of the soil as that foundation upon which everything else is built.
As we build the soil, we're able to grow our plants, feed them to our animals. That becomes nutrients for us so that we can reproduce, but we're also filling in these ecological niches and not destroying the soil and relying on these other things. Okay. One of your core values seems rather subversive, and that's civil disobedience through self-reliance. How does that fit into where you go with things? Or should I not ask this question and allow you to just wipe your hands of that and allow others to interpret it?
That's one where I think I would let others to interpret, but I will say that the whole idea of agriculture as it was laid out was to, quote, free us from work on the farm, right? And free us from this drudgery. And the irony is that we're more sort of enslaved in many ways and dependent on everyone else or on a small concentration of, if you want to call it, power. And I think that the quickest way back is that focus on self-reliance. And when we talk about self-reliance, it's that idea of self as more than you, and to consider self without community and without health of community on all levels, you know, whether beneath our feet and human on top. Like, so that's kind of where that comes from, but I will wave my hands a bit of it.
That's fine. I'll go ahead and put a little bit of my interpretation in here so that you can sit back from it and just let my thoughts go, and anybody who wants to respond to this can send this to me. My thought about it is that self-reliance is about personal responsibility, and that when you become personally responsible, there's a realization that there's only so much self-sufficiency that you can fit into that mold. And it was a big movement within my thought process when I thought about that farmer with their 40 acres doing everything by themselves, which was kind of this romanticized view that I held for a long time. And then when my daughter was at the point where she would sit and listen to stories, we read through the entire Little House on the Prairie series together. And you realize that, yes, Pa is out there. He builds their house. He's out there plowing and doing work. But he still calls on his neighbors to come over and help him. He still has to go to town from time to time to get the things that he can't make. And then I thought about the time of my grandfather as a farmer and speaking with other farmers. And it's like, well, I'm out here and I may be able to grow all my own food, but I still need to go see my guy who knows how to weld to come to fix a plow blade. You know, I may be able to do all these things. You referred to the Paul Harvey Dodge commercial, God Made a Farmer. And it's that thought about, you know, shoeing a horse with a car tire and holding a family together with bale and wire and all that stuff. We may have some of those views to make those kinds of repairs and those things in a pinch. And a farmer is certainly very skilled in their labor, but they aren't doing it alone. There are still many people that they rely on in order to build community. But going back to that first part of the statement is that as you become more self-reliant and self-sufficient, there's less of a need for other larger organizations to help take care of you and your community, because you and your community have built this interrelated working with each other.
Exactly.
Long roundabout kind of way to get there, tying some things. So
you said it much better than we can. I mean, that was perfect. I was going to say, I wish I could record it, but I think we already did, right?
Yeah. All this is being recorded and will be part of the episode that people get to listen to when it's all put together. The last value on the list was take time for tea. Is that just a reminder to take time to relax, or is that to take some time and make some compost tea and make sure you're feeding your nutrients?
It's all those things. So it's compost tea, and it's also those good old growth teas, those living teas, just like compost teas, are really an act of self-reflection. And taking a bowl of tea for every meeting that we have, it always starts with a kettle. And we've been really into, my friend's got some great old growth Pu'er tea that he's brought back, and that ritual of sort of using a bowl and ensuring that both hands are on it focuses or requires attention, and it requires sort of stopping what you're doing. And so it is a nod to compost tea, but it's also a nod to that time for self-reflection, and also in a very ceremonial way, kind of taking in the nutrients that these trees have been sort of bringing up for years and centuries in some cases. So it's a reminder to kind of slow down, and it's also a symbolic reconnection point, acknowledgement of the medicinal aspects of agriculture and cultivation. The way we start, all right, let's have some tea, let's take some steps back, and then we'll hash some things out. Stop, reflect. It's important to do that because we're kind of non-stop, and so without something to remind us to reflect intentionally, it's kind of hard to do it. I'm sure you can relate. Having an incredible podcast and being a dad, it sounds like to multiple kids, it's hard to find those times. And gardening provides that, backyard farming, but it's too easy for those sorts of things to quickly turn into process and things that we have to do if we don't take time to consciously sort of reflect.
I can understand all of that very much, yes. Though I might not take time for tea, I'd take time for a pint. So, though, having had a job once where we could more or less take a pint whenever we wanted, it did not always lead to the most productive day.
Well, and that's where, you know, the Maxfield movement part of, like, so the Maxfield movement is, we believe that the hope, and I'll send this to you, but we believe that the hope for global agricultural harmony begins in every backyard. It starts with our own two hands. And these phrases are key across, we're very diligent and conscious with the things that we write. So the next part of the Maxfield movement is important on multiple levels. Establish your roots, work with nature, celebrate the harvest, and cultivate the farmer within. And I think celebrate the harvest is that time where you do take those times for a pint, or take time to celebrate the gifts that the season brought. And it's important to take those times actually to celebrate. So whether it's a pint or tea or whatever, like, it's crucial.
I appreciate all the places that we've gone through this, and to know that you've taken all these ideas and these core values, your purpose and mission for the company, and turned this not only into being financially viable, but allowing that process of building a business to serve as a way to leverage your other goals and your other desires, as I'm always interested in many ways, to build a better world. And that's really cool to me to have sat down and had this conversation with you and know that someone is productive doing something that seems so alternative or radical to the regular kind of things that are going on in the world, that you've made a productive business out of collecting compost. And I've heard about like growing power and everything, but there's, as much as I want to talk to Will Allen, and I keep my fingers crossed one day I will after I read his book and understand the viewpoint to approach him with, but that business has grown so large that he can leverage the name of Growing Power and himself for grants and everything else to allow it to be productive and grow without needing to always be seeking profitability.
And that's key. And that's why we're excited, because waste farmers, it's hard when you start out because people want to define, especially in a short-term driven economy, like what X product are you making for Y market? You don't get the ability and flexibility to have a nebulous concept. So waste farmers will always hold that place, that spiritual place, and that place where we ask big questions and think in ways that cause us to learn more and seek truth. And Maxfield is a manifestation of that, is a practical application of how these things manifest. And from a practical perspective, which we didn't touch on, you know, the urban farming and urban homesteading movement is sort of akin to where I think the outdoor active lifestyle side of things was when Yvon Chouinard started with Patagonia. I mean, people were buying all of their tools at Army surplus stores, and there wasn't any to the point where he was making them. And so he kind of helped to define brand, provide products that fit that lifestyle. And we hope Maxfield, in our line of products that grow to empower and cultivate the farmer and everyone, kind of does the same thing. So we're really excited. And I think we've reached critical mass to where the collective momentum is moving there, and we're excited to see where it progresses.
And I'm excited to follow you and see where you wind up from here. It's really nice to have gotten to take this time to meet you right at this kind of the cusp of this next phase, and to be able to see where you go from here. It's really exciting to see both the Maxfield's brand be able to grow and then allow that to feed the waste farmers and do all these great things. It's really cool.
Thank you. Thanks for what you're doing as well. It's an honor to be on the show, and we're grateful. So thank you.
I appreciate that. Sometimes being the guy sitting behind the microphone in front of a computer, not outside doing the good work, if you will, but doing the technical stuff, it feels a little strange to do it and know how many people are listening to the show and then going a long time without any feedback. But then myself, I'm also at that critical mass point where it's beginning to feed itself and grow even more. And that's really cool for me to see. And it's still strange that anyone would appreciate the work that I'm doing so much. So it's always nice to hear. But I've had you here for a while now, and from everything else going on in the background, it sounds like you are busy. And as you say, it's a busy time of year, so I don't want to keep you much longer. But is there anything else that you'd like to share with the listeners before we bring everything to a close?
I would share what that mentor for me shared that kind of gave me hope in the midst of a lot of no's and a lot of people thinking that we're crazy. And this wasn't his advice, but I think my advice would be the crazier the idea sounds, the more likely you are on to something. And give yourself the space to trust your intuition and listen to it, because it's right for you. And if it's right for you and you're doing the things that fulfill your purpose, however you call it, you create the space for other people too as well. And the thing that this mentor said to me that has given us renewed life, because we respect him a great deal, he said, don't just dream big, dream bigger. And so, you know, we've kind of plastered that all over our place. So dream bigger, because these things that we're talking about are indeed possible. You just got to continue to push forward.
And realize what today may have seemed impossible, tomorrow will make real.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, JP, for joining me for this interview and taking the time to share the work that you're doing. I think that it serves as a great model for people who want to make change in the place that they find themselves, and as we said in the very beginning, to bridge that difference between business and making a living and their ideals and making a difference in the world. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that was our time with J.P. Maxfield. Listening to how he and his team use ideals and core values to guide their work, and that need to take time for reflection, what do you do in your own life to stop and consider your position and choices? Have you ever written down your core values? What beliefs guide your actions and set a purpose to them? Whatever they may be, I'd love to hear from you. show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or give me a call, 717-827-6266. If you like this or any other episode of the show, please consider making a donation. You can find out how to do that, including a recurring monthly micropayment, as well as how to follow the show on Facebook or Twitter at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. The next episode will be an interview with Dr. Wayne Dorbin from the Mountain Sky Group and his work in developing a green hacker space, which is a maker or create space designed for people interested in creating sustainable solutions. Our conversation is an open and very transparent one about business and his long-standing ongoing efforts to make the world a better place using the tools of an entrepreneur. After that show, I'm looking to release an episode about my biography to tie together the bits and pieces I've alluded to in various episodes and lend a perspective of how I got from information technology and a very computer-heavy pre-permaculture world to this place now where I'm your host, and hope that that can serve as inspiration for you and the path that you're on, wherever you may be, that you too can walk down whatever road it is you wish to follow and make a difference in your own life. Lastly, the syllabus for the online PDC is coming together fairly quickly. If you contacted me with your interest about that, expect that document in the next week or so. If this is your first time hearing about that online PDC and you'd like a copy of the syllabus, send me an email to the show address. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.